Okay.
So it is no.
Hello?
Hi, it's Kim Schaefer.
Hello. Hi, Kim. Kim Schaefer is also with us at the FCIC. So, Kim, we're just about to get started.
So, it is November 11th, 2010. My name is Chris Schaefer. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We are interviewing Mr. Wing Chow. Mr. Chow, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. We appreciate it. We were established, the FCIC was established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by the end of this year. That statute tells us to look at many things, including the role, if any, of securitization, the originate-to-distribute model, structured finance, and all that kind of stuff. So we thought it would certainly make sense to talk to you, given your background, both at Maxim and Harding, and your what I understand to be your also relevant background before that at various companies. So with that, as I said before we threw on the recording device, could we start out, please, by having you just briefly summarize your educational and work background, starting with college?
Sure, thanks. Hi, this is Wayne Chow. I graduated from the University of Rhode Island with a BA in economics and subsequently earned my Master's of Business Administration at Babson College in Wellesley, Mass. After graduating from grad school, I moved on to a series of jobs in the Wall Street community, starting with Prudential Securities, where I started as a research analyst, and moved on to be a research analyst at Solomon Brothers, and through a couple of other job transfers, I was the portfolio manager at New York Life, and moved on from New York Life to head a series of trading desks, one at SoftGen, another at Nomura Securities, and ultimately joined Maxim Group in 2004 to help establish a asset management business, and spun out of Maxim in 2006 to form Harding Advisory, which is the asset manager that it exists today.
Mm-hmm. And when did you join?
Excuse me, did you work with Chris Ricciardi when you were at Prudential Securities?
Yes, I did.
So when in 2004 did you join Maxim?
I don't recall the specific date, but it was probably mid-2004, I believe.
Okay, and then
mid to late 2000.
And then same question for Harding. When did you start Harding?
July of 2006.
Okay. Okay, and were the jobs the same at Maxim and Harding, and if not, can you explain how they were different?
Sure. At Maxim, I was hired to build the asset management business to be the head of the group, and at Harding, which was subsequently the company that I created, my role was to continue to build upon the CDO business.
Okay, so can you explain to us what your job was at Maxim, and then I'll ask you to do the same at Harding.
Sure. At Maxim Advisory, I was charged with building the business, which meant that I had to hire the appropriate staff, help develop the necessary tools to invest in fixed income securities, help market the Maxim brand name to be selected as collateral managers for CDO mandates, and to help with the overall management of the asset management business.
Okay. So, I mean, what I was getting at is at Maxim and Harding, was essentially the business, that the business of a collateral manager?
Yes.
Okay. And to the understanding that, were there any differences between the collateral manager businesses at Maxim and Harding, or were they essentially the same type of business?
They were essentially the same type of business.
Okay. So can you just describe, so we have it for the record, what the job of a collateral manager is?
Yeah, the role of the collateral manager is clearly defined in the investment mandate and collateral management agreement. It is one where the collateral manager is hired to invest for the CDO trust based on the eligibility criteria that's established at the outset. That is to find appropriate assets that meet all the relevant metrics for the CDO, such as, that is a debt security, what asset class it would be, what sector it would be. It's all defined, predetermined, where the collateral manager has very little latitude as to what sectors to invest in, but what they can actually, they can select assets within the pre-described sectors that have been pre-agreed upon at the inception of the CDO.
And when you say pre-agreed on at the inception of the CDO, pre-agreed on by who?
By the CDO trust with the investors that are in the CDOs, with the rating agencies that have to rate the capital structure. It's a collaborative agreement where the investment banks are working with their clients as to what exposures that their clients would like to attain, and the CDO is created that reflects the investment asset allocation by the client for that investment bank.
Mm-hmm. So how do collateral managers get paid?
They get compensated based on the on the par value of the assets and the CDO trust. It's basically a flat fee, anywhere from 10 to 40 basis points, depending on the asset class. And some of that fees are structured as base management fees, and some of it is structured as incentive management fees. But it's and it's spelled out in every offering memorandum of the CDOs.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the fee structure typically for an ABS CDO? You said it depended on the asset class.
Yeah, exactly. If it was a, as you mentioned, if it was a collateralized loan obligation, you would get paid anywhere from 50 to 75 basis points. But for a typical asset-backed CDO, which would be backed by residential mortgages, commercial mortgages, other consumer assets, depending on the underlying rating of the investments, if it was a what the industry terms as a high-grade CDO transaction, where the assets are, underlying assets are rated single A and higher, the management fees typically were 10 to 15 basis points. For a CDO backed by residential mortgage backed securities rated single A and lower, triple B, no, predominantly triple B and lower, the fees ranged anywhere from 20 to basis points to 100 basis points, depending on the manager.
And what if they if it was synthetic collateral, would it be based on the total amount, including the super senior unfunded, or would it be based on funded?
No, it's based on the underlying assets, so it's not based on the liabilities of the CDO. The management fees are based on what the CDO holds. So if it's a synthetic CDO backed by 100% credit default swaps, the management fee would be calculated on the on the par value of those credit default swaps, less any rating agency haircuts below a certain threshold.
Okay, so the so it's similar whether it's cash or synthetic. It's based on pretty much the par value of the assets.
Exactly.
Okay.
Sorry, you gave fairly broad ranges for these fees. I'm not clear whether you were speaking of the market in general or your experience at Maxim and Harding.
That was for the market in general. At Maxim, the fees ranged for high-grade transactions anywhere from 5 to 15 basis points, I believe. And for mezzanine deals, it ranged from anywhere from 10 to 40 basis points.
And did this change over time? And would the fee in the first quarter of 06 be different from the fee in the first quarter of 07?
Yes, fees clearly changed over time. I think initially for mezzanine transactions, the typical management contracts were signed at anywhere from 30 to 40 basis points. And over the as any industry matures, the pressure on fees is ever, you know, pressured downward. And manager fees for mezzanine deals we're drifting into the 20 to, you know, 10, 15 to 20 basis point realm, which is, you know, clearly a function of a maturing market.
And for the high grade?
High grades, you know, since they already started so low, there is really not much less you can go down. I think to run a management business, you need a minimum of 8 to 10 basis points. And that's universal. If you look at any asset manager outside the CDO world that is managing fixed income products, there is a minimal threshold of earnings that you need to run a business.
Perhaps I misheard, but I thought you said that at either Harding or Maxim, you earned as little as 5 basis points on some high.
Oh, yes, exactly. And that would be, you know, and 5 was because it was a static transaction where there was no active management. And 15 basis points was because it was a actively managed transaction. Post Maxim, Harding did mostly managed transactions, so we were charging the typical industry fees.
And did you mostly do?
And is either place? Did you do any CLOs, or was it all ABS-CDOs?
It was all ABS-CDOs. We were looking to expand into the CLO market.
So what made ABS an attractive asset class for the CDO?
At that point in time, it was the relative stability. If you look back at history, the initial high-yield CDO transactions, collateralized bond obligations, they were backed by high-yield debt of corporations. And if you look back at the 1999-2001 recession, industry fell into disarray as we are today in the ABS-CDO market. And when you look back in time, the high-yield CDO market completely imploded. It was the same exact situation where the CDOs were collateralized by, you know, single B, double B rated corporate bonds. When the recession hit, the bonds fell in value and the CDO market pretty much fell into disarray. Post 2001, I believe everyone looked at the sector and said, well, the CDO construct works, but we just need to find more stable collateral. And the industry looked at residential mortgage-backed securities, you know, Alt-A, subprime, and non-agency mortgages, and saw the relative stability. And that stability has been championed by the rating agencies, amongst others, and as well as investors who have lived through this the last 20 years, where investments in mortgage-backed securities held while investments in highly levered corporations failed. And so the industry took off when it found the asset class that made the most sense to investors.
So is part of this the yield? I mean, is there a minimum yield that you need in order to make the CDO work?
To function? Yeah, it's always a function of the arbitrage, and the arbitrage is based on debt loss. So in terms of financing the CDO, you need to... CDO is nothing more than a financing vehicle. So when you look at the CDO's liability structure, depending on what investors are willing to invest and be compensated at, determines the arbitrage level. So, for example, if the underlying liability investors demands that they be compensated at LIBOR plus 200, to call it an example, you would need to have a portfolio that would yield you more than LIBOR plus 200 to make the arbitrage work. And so it's all a function of supply and demand.
So I guess another way of putting it would be, would it be possible to do this with prime mortgages, or do you need subprime, which have a, 200, 300 basis points higher yield?
No, you could do it with prime mortgages. It all depends on what the asset yields were at the time. And And I think prime mortgages were mostly fixed rate mortgages. And because of that, there was an inherent inability to use fixed rate mortgages in a CDO structure, because the CDO liabilities are priced on a LIBOR basis. So it'll float with LIBOR. And if you try to buy assets that are fixed in nature, you have a huge interest rate mismatch, which is very tough to hedge. And with prime mortgages, they're notorious for having prepayment optionality. So when you have a potential interest rate mismatch that is highly sensitive assets, such as prime mortgages, because if rates go down, borrowers refinance very aggressively, and if rates go up, the borrowers do not refinance and the bonds extend, and that introduces a lot of risk that's very difficult to gauge, especially for the rating agencies. The rating agencies have a very difficult time measuring interest rate gap risk like that.
Mr. Chow, you had mentioned earlier about when you talked about the fees, that there was a base fee, and then I think you said there was also an incentive fee, or you used a different term. But can you describe what the incentive fee, or whatever term you used, was based upon, how it worked?
Sure. So for a typical mezzanine CDO transaction, that's a CDO backed by securities that are rated single A, triple B, or below, there would be a senior management fee paid, which was roughly 20 basis points, and that would be paid at the senior portion of the waterfall. So as the underlying assets pay interest into the trust, the trust then makes a series of payments to all the stakeholders. One, the top, as always, is paid for taxes that are accrued, and for any attorney work. It seems that the attorneys have a very good way of drafting, that they get paid for this before anyone else. And then after that, depending on deal, either the trustee fee gets paid, and then the collateral manager fee gets paid, and then the AAA investors get paid, and then down the waterfall. The subordinate manager fee was normally paid after the BBB investor was paid, so which meant that the deal had to perform at the BBB level for the manager to earn its incentive management fee. And there was also an additional incentive fee that the industry allowed, in the sense that if the equity investor got paid a certain IRR, then some of that equity interest cash flows could be used to pay the collateral manager as an added incentive.
So what were the relative proportions of these?
For the industry, it was pretty much 20 basis points senior, 20 basis points below at the BBB level, and then there was a equity sharing percentage, which varied dramatically from deal to deal.
So what was the range of that?
I'm not too sure, but Harding never did the equity sharing incentive fees.
Okay. And for you said for the industry it was 20 and 20 basis points. What was it usually for Harding?
By the time we got into the CDO mezzanine transactions, the latter deals were more 10 to 15 basis points, and most of it was senior.
Can you explain to us how you would go about getting business? I mean, I think we've seen in the documents that we've seen that you were doing a lot of deals with Merrill, but how did you at Harding go about getting the business to being a collateral manager? Explain to us how that works.
Sure. As with all collateral managers, we all market ourselves as investment managers to the industry, and we go to just like TCW, BlackRock, Fidelity, New York Life, all the relevant CDO managers. They have to demonstrate to the investment community that they are a bona fide investment manager that can have the ability to manage these assets in a CDO construct. We then would market ourselves to the investment banks, and the investment banks, we would meet with all the investment banks, and market to them our ability to be a qualified asset manager. And what tends to happen is that the investment banks are always in touch with their clients, and their clients are telling them who they would like to invest with. And to the extent that the investment bank believes that they can underwrite a transaction with Harding as the CDO manager and can sell all the liabilities, they would then entertain an arrangement where we would be selected as the CDO manager.
You mentioned that clients, would talk to the IBs about who. I mean, that part I don't understand, I guess, so much. So folks that are ultimately investing in the CDO have a preference about who's selecting the collateral and then managing the collateral after selection?
I would believe so. As a personal, if you invested in a closed-end bond fund, would you rather invest with BlackRock or PIMCO or TCW? It's one the investor has made a conscious decision. In the CDO, for CDO investors, I believe every CDO investor has already made a conscious decision to allocate a certain percentage of their investment portfolio in CDO assets. Once they've made that their own internal approval to invest in that sector, they then look to see who they should allocate those investment dollars with. Is it BlackRock? Is it TCW? And when you look at the industry is dominated by the trust company in the West, by BlackRock. And I think that's where you see the investors make their decisions as to who they want to invest with.
Mm-hmm. Would the investor
also invest with...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Fine. The investors also want to invest with other managers. They like to invest with emerging managers. I believe a lot of it would be part of the diversification. I don't think not one investor would like to have 100% allocation to one manager. That would be similar to what unfortunately has happened to some investors with Madoff. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think you want to have this decision to have a diversified portfolio of managers.
So would the investment banks, I've looked at a lot of documents, not necessarily related to Harding or Maxim or even Merrill, but the iBanks essentially, requesting bids from various collateral managers to say, hey, we're putting together or thinking of putting together a CDO, send us a bid about, what you would charge to be the collateral manager. Did it work like that at all with you, either at Maxim or Harding?
Yes, everyone was always conscious about fees, and for the CDO trust to work, I think depending on the arbitrage, only so much can be paid in any one deal. And as the industry matures, there's always pressure on the management fees. And when you're marketing, you're also marketing what your ability to charge.
Mm-hmm. Who were the folks that were investing in the CDOs that Harding managed, the types of investors, and how did that change over time, if at all?
I think the typical investors in the CDOs are insurance companies, finance companies, banks, both domestic and abroad, other CDO managers, other asset managers. It's pretty much a wide range, hedge funds. And for the AAA investors, it could have predominantly were structured investment vehicles, what they call SIVs.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the monolines, MBIA, AMBAC, FIDIC, SCA, AIG. AIG wasn't a monoline, AIG was an insurance company. Foreign banks, Calion, SocGen, Paribas, Deutsche Bank, investment banks, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Wells Fargo, Wachovia at the time, but now Wells Fargo, Citigroup, pretty much the entire investment universe in fixed income.
And
would invest in CDOs.
And that was, you had started out before you listed all those types of folks as the AAA tranches. Were all those types of companies that you mentioned investing in the AAAs, or were they also investing in the lower tranches?
They could have invested in the lower tranches, I think. So for the investment banks, clearly, but for the monoline insurance companies, mostly AAA. I think that's their mandate.
Mm-hmm. And then what did that change at all over time, or did you see a change in the mix and the type of investors that were investing in either the AAA or the lower rated tranches?
Yeah, the sale of the securities was handled mostly by the investment banks, and they would have the best feel for that. But for the AAA investors, it had been the monolines and insurance companies. I think in the press, AIG had backed away from taking down super senior exposure in 2005-2006, and subsequently, I think the monoline insurance companies increased their demand at that time frame. But in terms of noticeable changes in investor mix, I don't recall there was a substantial change.
Other than monolines increasing their demand when AIG pulled back from the market, did you see any other impact on the market by AIG stopping writing protection on super senior tranches?
No. As a matter of fact, liabilities got tighter. The pricing of super senior risk was actually lower after AIG left the industry.
That sort of seems counterintuitive. Do you have any explanation for that?
The investment world thought that there was no risk at the super senior layer. That these were, as the name implies, super senior AAA, which meant that there was a substantial credit enhancement below you, and that there was very minimal risk for credit losses if you believe in the super senior AAA rating that Moody's put together.
Mm-hmm.
And which the investment community did. I mean, that's everyone. I can think of no one at that time when these deals were being created thought that the super senior layer was at risk.
Mm-hmm. How did, you know, we've seen, you know, some of the offering circulars for deals that Harding and Maxim and others were collateral managers for, and we've seen flip books and things like that, and they all, you know, tell us generally how collateral managers went about selecting collateral for the CDOs. And you mentioned earlier, you know, that there was criteria spelled out. But can you just sort of walk us through and help us understand the collateral selection process?
Mm-hmm. So in the beginning of the CDO business, the most of the CDO assets were what we call in cash format, were real securities issued by mortgage originators, by investment banks, by mortgage banks. And these were the securities that populated the earlier CDOs. But before we get there, I think the eligibility criteria was established at the beginning of any CDO mandate, whereby the investment bank, having met with their investors, I believe, would come up with a series of sectors that they would like the CDO to have exposure to. Those sectors are then communicated to us, and we look at the relevant sectors, and at that point in time, the investment banks normally ask, you know, can you buy a portfolio of assets based on these requirements that can meet a certain threshold yield requirement? And CDO managers would look at the investment opportunities and make a determination, you know, can they buy an appropriate portfolio of assets that meet all the eligibility criteria with constraints and still provide a yield that would make the arbitrage work. And if that was the case, and there was an agreement, the investment bank and the collateral manager would then enter into an underwriting agreement to commence the CDO transaction. The investment bank would typically provide a warehouse line of credit to finance all the assets that would be ultimately deposited into the CDO trust. And during this warehousing phase, the investment bank is at risk for the underlying portfolio. They have market risks, they have credit risks, And if the CDO is not ultimately issued, they will be long those securities, and we'll have to do, and we'll have to face the any price changes that would have occurred between inception and the potential launch date. And because of that, they normally require that they have the ultimate approval of any assets that go into their warehouse, because they are ultimately responsible for the risks. And along the way, the rating agencies are vetting this entire capital structure, and the rating agencies are very heavily involved at this point, because they need to understand what sectors are going into this CDO, what weighted average life, what maturities, what ratings, all the necessary inputs that the rating agency needs to put into their model to come up with a capital rating structure for the CDO. How, what percentage of the CDO will be rated AAA, what percentage will be rated AA, what percentage will be rated single A. And for them to make that determination, they need to understand what is in the CDO, and what asset class, what sectors, what ratings.
Did you have conversations directly with the rating agencies?
The investment banks handle most of the structuring of the transaction. We would interact with the rating agencies during the actual negotiation of the offering memorandum and the indenture, in terms of what type of constraints that are feasible.
So at this point in time that you were describing, in terms of asset selection and determining what sorts of categories and criteria, you are not speaking with the rating agencies. Is that correct?
No. Now, the rating agencies have provided the investment banking community and the investment world a series of criteria that they are able to rate a CDO based on this criteria. And that criteria has provided the transparency that the investment banks needed to help structure these transactions. And without that criteria that the rating agencies provide, investment banks would not have been able to come up with a capital structure that would become rateable. So I think it's one where the investment banks and rating agencies have worked together to come to an agreement that, based on their research, the Moody's research and S&P's research, because they're the ones that do all the correlation modeling and all the other things that a CDO ratings needs, they provide to the investment banks the criteria in which a deal can be rated. We're not part of that transaction. We're not part of that. As a collateral manager, we're hired to invest the proceeds of the CDO into assets that meet investment criteria.
So let me ask you, the first two criteria that you talked about in there, or maybe not, were sectors. You said there would be eligibility criteria based on sectors, and then there was a threshold yield that needed to be met. Were there other eligibility criteria besides sectors to be included in the CDO and a threshold yield to be met?
Oh yeah. I mean, if you looked at the document, it's probably 15 pages of eligibility criteria. And a lot of it is driven by the rating agencies. The CDO sector was created by the rating agencies. They provide the criteria in which a deal can get securitized. But when you look at the criteria, it can also be negative covenants. Now, you cannot buy government debt, for example. I mean, you can't buy Fannie and Freddie agency debt. There is a criterion there. I think the biggest criteria of all is that any security that is invested that is eligible must have a rating from one of the NRS ROs. In no uncertain terms, the only way the deal can be rated is that the securities that underlie that transaction have a credit rating. Whether it's investment grade or below investment grade, it all depends on what the investors would like to have exposure to.
And how would the threshold yield get determined generally?
That's determined by market forces. So the investment banks are canvassing their clients, and they know where CDO liabilities are pricing, And based on their market intelligence, they can say, okay, the current, in today's environment, the CDO liabilities, the all-in cost of financing a CDO trust is, for example, for a high-grade transaction, is LIBOR plus 40. Now, can you buy a deal that, can you buy assets on a weighted average basis that can exceed LIBOR plus 40? Can you buy a pool of assets at LIBOR plus 50, LIBOR plus 60? And so, market forces dictates what can or cannot be done. So if we look in the marketplace and single A, double A, triple A securities are all pricing at LIBOR plus 20, and the liability cost of the CDO is LIBOR plus 40, then there can be no deal that can get done because there's a negative arbitrage. Mm-hmm.
And generally, this may have asked in a different way before, but given that supply and demand was determining the threshold yield, I mean, was there a change in the kind of collateral, you know, that we're going into these deals to meet that threshold yield? And in general, you know, were folks buying the quote-unquote riskier securities that had the higher stated yield to meet the investor demanded threshold yield?
No, I think the in terms of the threshold yield requirement, they're all determined by the asset mix as well. So to the extent that the earlier CDOs, if you could buy, and I think if you look at the collateral composition, I don't believe there was a dramatic change. I think if you look at what comprised an ABS CDO, it had always been residential mortgage-backed securities, whether they're subprime, mid-prime, Alt-A, B and C, scratch and dent. That had always been the collateral mix for ABS CDOs, the major component of it. Mm-hmm. The other asset-backed securities that potentially could have fit into a CDO were trading at too tight of a level. For example, credit cards. If you couldn't put too many credit card transactions into a CDO because the credit card prices were trading well through the CDO liability costs. So you don't have credit card transactions. So it all depends on the investors as well, to the extent that an investor is willing to take a lower yield and they want to have their credit card exposure, you know, they'll make it known. For example, the super senior class, as they're looking to invest in a CDO, they're heavily involved in the early stages of a deal that says, okay, we want to have this exposure. And if they didn't want us to have subprime exposure, they would tell you that we only want maximum 30% subprime exposure. But they wanted a exposure to autos and consumer assets, they would ask for it, and then the investment bank would then work the model and say, okay, this is what yield can come out of a deal if you put these assets into it.
In any deals that you were involved in, were there requests for exposures to autos or credit cards?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Or any other consumer assets that were not mortgages?
Not residential. No. I think most people looked at the universe of investable assets and to meet the yield needs of a CDO, it predominantly fell onto the residential mortgage-backed security sector.
And the yield needs in the deals that you were involved with, were they expected or modeled or marketed IRRs for the equity 20%, 15%, 12%? What were they?
Yeah, they ranged anywhere from 15 to 20-plus percent. And that was the industry average.
So let me ask you. You had mentioned that in terms, eligibility criteria, there's certain sectors that are going to be in the deals, and then any security that's selected has to be rated by the rating agencies. What kind of other work would you guys at Maxim and Harding do to analyze the collateral other than to say it's rated and we're in these sectors and when we pool them all together they'll generate a yield that's going to meet the threshold yield?
You know, we employed a staff of investment professionals to look at the underlying securities and basically just make sure that we're not missing anything. We looked at the investment securities and we would get the underlying perspectives and offer memorandums for those securities and look at the collateral of those securities and vet through our system to see if that these RMBS securities, met the industry standards at the time, that they were appropriately originated, and we would look to see if there was any outliers in terms of collateral composition in these securities. But most of these securities, unfortunately, you have no real say in terms of if you didn't like the securities, you just didn't buy them, because most of these securities were being launched at new issue oversubscribed 3 to 5 times. And so there was a huge amount of demand for these residential mortgage-backed securities.
Was there a certain type of collateral? You mentioned the collateral in the securities. Was there a certain type of collateral that you didn't like or a certain type that you liked better?
Well, the securities that we didn't like, Clinton was probably, 100%, second lien transactions or scratch and dent transactions, deals that had a lot of credit problems to begin with, and that you were relying on credit enhancement to protect you at that investment rating. We had a negative weighting towards pay option arms. Those are what they call pay mortgages that were originated primarily by Golden, I believe Golden West at the time, which was ultimately bought by Wachovia. And those loans have shown that at this point in time they have substantial repayment problems. We clearly looked at what made sense. There were deals that had a lot of mortgage-backed securities deals that had a lot of interest rate optionality built into it that we didn't like, avoided those. I think that's what investors liked. I mean, they liked when we were very transparent. These are the sectors that we invested in, and it coincided with their own internal allocation to those sectors.
Mr. Chow, this is Pete Kaminis, also from the FCIC, and I had a couple more questions on the underlying assets, and I was hoping you could actually explain a couple of things, because that's sort of the area that I'm interested in.
Pre-ask a question. This is Eddie Daniels. I just want to make sure that I have your name right.
Sure.
It's
Peter Kaminis. K-A-V as in Victor, O-U, N as in Nancy, A-S as in Sam.
Thank you.
No problem.
I'm sorry to interrupt your question.
No, not at all.
Is there anyone else on?
I don't think I've introduced myself.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
This is Greg Feldberg. I'm the research director. I just came in late, so I didn't introduce myself before. Sorry.
Great. Not a problem. Thank you.
Sure. In terms of the underlying assets, you were sort of explaining how, as you'd sort of said, they were relatively already rated, or the class was kind of selected by the rating agency or kind of given to you, and you guys then did some investigation, some background on those. And I'd just like to kind of find out what, what sort of investigation you did on those. I mean, essentially, I wanted to know, obviously, the only way to really rate those would be using a FICO score, loan-to-value ratio, what kind of criteria you guys had in place to kind of determine what was, truly an asset that was being valued.
Sure. No, our job was not to re-rate the securities.
Of course.
And no investment, very few investors in any asset class would re-rate the securities. Now, our job is to have the appropriate staff, in my work experience, to look at, in history, what has been previously originated and what collateral profile those securities have had, and what their performance had been. And when you act, and unfortunately, we're creatures of habit and creatures of experience, you look back at history and you say, based on this pool that has just been shown to me, this Wells Fargo pool, based on the weighted average FICO scores, the stratification of the FICO scores, loan-to-values, based on our prior experience of securities of similar collateral type, they performed at the same level, at the triple H will be level or whichever tranche, and that there would be no belief that it wouldn't perform otherwise. So for us, it was just more to make sure that that the rating agencies hadn't drifted too much in terms of what they had done in the past, and also with the originators. And you know, we would meet with the originators at the various conferences and talk to them about the origination process, their servicing process, to make sure that they have a clearly bona fide business. But you know, we do rely a lot on the rating agencies because they are the independent arbiters of risk. And we do depend on the investment banks that sell the securities, that they made the appropriate reps and warranties, that these securities have been originated with underwriting standards and guidelines that have been pre-established.
Of course.
So once we go through that, we compare the current offering versus the historical trends and industry trends. We didn't notice any significant drift. Had we known, now that we've listened to the FCIC testimony on the Clayton letter, had we known that there were deals being originated with up to 60-80% exceptions to a pool, that would have been troubling. That would have raised red flags. Unfortunately, we didn't have access to that information.
Sure. Well, and one of the things actually you brought up that I think is a very interesting point, and I'd like to find out a little bit more about that. You essentially what you said, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, but correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that in order to sort of judge the criteria based on whether or not it fit, for example, a AAA, and this is obviously just an example, I have no idea if this would work, but saying sort of a AAA based pool of assets, let's say the credit score had to be, somewhere between 700 and 750. Some sort of relation that you had like that, is it possible for you to kind of give us a little bit more insight as to, sort of how you valued specifically the rating score and then translated that into the S&P or the Moody's rating? Do you understand my question? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, exactly. No, and it's all based on experience. And when you look at, for example, the prime mortgages that you just explained, if you had a pool of 750 FICO borrowers and you were investing at the AAA level, you would only probably need 4% credit subordination below you. Some deals were done with 3.5% subordination below you. Some deals were done with 6% subordination. And it all hinged on the rating agency's belief in terms of the quality of the originating assets by originators. So, for example, Chase would always be given the benefit of the doubt because Chase has historically originated very quality prime borrower mortgages. And when you look at their credit enhancement levels, you would expect to see only 3.5% subordination to the AAA. When you got a pool of mortgages from, say, by Washington Mutual, if it was a Washington Mutual deal, they have a very high concentration in California. Although that they have the same FICO ranges, their subordination levels would probably be more closer to 5-6% because of the inherent bias against Washington Mutual over Chase. And so we would have that historical context, and that's what we would be looking at as well. In terms of, are we being given the appropriate enhancement levels? Because when you look back in time, even during the 2000-2001 recession, the Chase mortgages performed, and the AAAs were AAA and stayed AAA. And even the Washington Mutual deals, they were AAA rated in 2001, when the recession hit, they still were rated AAA. And you look at that stability of ratings is what drove the CDO industry, the ABS CDO industry, because when you look back in time of stresses, and we can only extrapolate from what we know. Unfortunately, we can't extrapolate from the future. And based on what we knew from prior experience, these securities should handle a traditional recession. What these securities cannot handle was a recession of all times that rivaled the Great Depression. And they can't handle a complete deleveraging of the capital markets. And no one could. If you look at who was at risk in 2008, it wasn't just the typical subprime borrower or the Alt-A borrower. It was GE, you have a AAA rated industrialist company that was at risk of failure because they couldn't roll over the commercial paper, and the federal government had to come in and open up the commercial paper program for them. You had leading banks at the brink of failure, and it's because once you take away the leverage and you do not provide a replacement for that refinancing, anyone that has borrowed money is at risk for default. And unfortunately, for the residential mortgage borrowers, Congress did not quick enough to provide that source of financing to backstop this contagion. Because if you look at the commercial mortgage-backed market, it survived because the U.S. government provided the backstop on prices. Right? The commercial mortgage sector was on the same path of destruction as the residential mortgage sector. There was an ample amount of overlending in the commercial mortgage side, and every community bank is chock full of construction loans. And the CMBS index, everyone's so focused on these indices, the CMBS index at the AAA level hit 50 cents on a dollar, which implied that everything was going to default. And it was on its way to default until the federal government came in and provided the capital needed to refinance the sector. Had the U.S. government provided the necessary finance to the normal mom and pop residential borrower, we wouldn't be in this situation. I mean, the fact that they allowed real estate prices to decelerate the way they did helped add it to this contagion. And when you look at commercial real estate, I think they realized that was the case, and they ultimately provided that backstop. They did TALF, CMBS. They provided the investment banks warehouse lines that they can post their commercial mortgages to for financing. Lehman Brothers, failed because of their commercial mortgage exposure, a large part due to that. And that was unnecessary. They could have saved Lehman just as well.
So
did you run any house pricing stresses in your analysis of?
We always ran stress analysis. We would run a range of credit default rates that had been historically been around. I think no one ever saw default rates at 50% in a pool before. I think
what sort of default stresses would you run?
Very similar to the rating agencies, and as well as all the other investors in the universe. It would range from a base case of 3 to 5% constant default rates to 10 to 15% constant default rates, and they normally, depending on the deal, the triple B tranche would of a residential mortgage-backed security would break at a 10 to 11% default rate. Triple A tranches would break at the closer to 15 to 20% default rate, and they're very consistent. What unfortunately lulled a lot of investors as well, and I'm in that camp as well, what lulled us into that sense of comfort was that the rating stability was so solid, and that it was so consistent. I mean, the rating agencies did a very good job of making everything consistent. So you knew that a AAA rated security was going to have X percentage of subordination. You knew a BBB security would have X percent of subordination. And once you knew what the subordination levels were, you can easily run a scenario analysis to see what the break-even points would be on a constant default rate and assuming a certain loss severity. And then you could get comfortable with that. And historically, we've never had where mortgage pools had 50% defaults, and that was unheard of. And we've never seen that before. And we've never seen loss severities as high as we have seen before. Before, when you foreclosed on a loan, and you had an 80% loan to value, depending on, and then obviously it's all hinged on the actual absolute dollar amount, you wouldn't expect to have more than 5 to 10% losses. So after you pay your $35,000 legal expenses for the foreclosure attorney, after you pay the back taxes and all these things, you had a 20% cushion, a buffer, to handle those costs, and housing prices were rising relatively within our last investment cycle. So you had very relative little losses. I remember a research panel had created where they showed that losses for California mortgages were less than 2% on any foreclosure. And based on that, all these securities survived. Now you look at the same statistics, and it's California mortgage losses could be easily 40-50%, not 2%.
did you receive street research from mortgage research from different dealers?
Oh yes, we did. We got mortgage research from all the investment banks, and what was interesting.
Did you like?
What's that?
Whose did you like?
That we liked? No, we I think they were all very credible. I mean, Lori Goodman was one of the best research analysts out there, and she was at various investment banks, including Deutsche Bank and others. They all basically had the same message, and in the sense that the rating stabilities were there. No one really focused on, unfortunately, housing price depreciation at the level that ultimately occurred. And no one should at that time, because it was a vibrant market. We had a vibrant capital markets. We had refinancing ability. I mean, what's driving housing prices to these low levels is the inability for buyers to find mortgages. And if you can't finance a new home and you have to pay cash for it, that limits the universe to a certain select few investors or potential homeowners, and that forces the prices down. And that's what's continuing to happen, because unless you have a, right now at this point in time, a perfect credit score and a real equity down payment, it's very difficult to get that mortgage. And if, you know, and if Fannie and Freddie weren't buying mortgages as they are right now, you would, that agency mortgage would also be seized up, because there's been very little done in the and the non-agency side. Maybe look at that. I may have seen maybe one securitization on the non-agency side. And it's because the investors are concerned. Right? There's a lot of still risks out there now that we now know, as well as the risk of foreclosure. The fact that the actual whole securitization mechanism is being challenged, it makes it very difficult for investors to make a credible decision to invest in mortgage-backed securities at this point in time. That aren't guaranteed by Fannie, Freddie, or Ginnie Mae.
How did you guys go about, you know, stressing the performance of the assets when I assume you had folks recognize? I mean, you've been talking about the consistency in the ratings from the rating agencies and the increases in home prices. One of the things, you know, we've seen here is, yeah, home prices were increasing at a rate that was much greater, you know, than the decades prior to the decades of the 2000s. One and two, you know, you had a lot of new non-traditional mortgage product out there, you know, that, as one you mentioned, were much more levered, you know, very low down payments, very high LTVs, required payment option arm loans, for example, very low payments that, you know, would reset 18 to 24 months down the road, negative AM features, you know, and things of that nature. So I get what you're saying about home prices increasing, but was there also a recognition at the time by you folks or other folks in general that, yeah, but they're increasing a whole lot more than they used to historically, and we have no history on these new non-traditional mortgage products, and so how do we stress test for how they'll perform in a down environment of home prices?
Yeah, and ultimately, I think the industry as a whole and myself, you know, we made our best guess as to, you know, educated guess as to what would outcome for these securities. And, you know, if we stayed on par with the, you know, the 3% GDP growth rate, if we stayed on par with the traditional refund mechanism, these securities would survive. And the rating agencies gave it their AAA stamp on all these securities. And I think when you look back with perfect hindsight, you know, you say, oh, you know, this was so obvious. How could you have missed this? You know, we can say that right now of the commercial mortgage-backed loans. If you look at the commercial mortgage-backed of commercial mortgage-backed loans that go into the securities market, in which the federal government now owns, courtesy of the federal bailout, these loans were underwritten where rents would escalate 7.5%, 5% to 7.5% per annum over the life of the loan. Well, we now know rent rates have dropped by 40% in most major metropolitan areas, and so most of these loans that were underwritten to these rosy forecasts no longer can cash flow. And so we can use the same metric and say, okay, well, how did the commercial lenders not realize that? And why did they believe in this rosy 5 to 7% growth rate in rent rates, which, as you said, you know, if you look back 10 years ago, that never happened either. It was You know, based on the investment decisions at the time, where landlords thought they could get those rent rates,
mm-hmm.
and they took those loans based on that. And now, if you look at a revised net operating income basis loan, these loans should be marked down appropriately, but they're not. They're still marked at 98 cents on the dollar for the most part for most financial institutions.
Going back to the assets, the collateral selection process, you've described a lot about how you guys would go about determining whether something was appropriate for the CDO. But you also mentioned a while back that ultimately the investment bank had to approve it because they were bearing the warehouse risk as the CDO was being built. Do you ever have any, you know, did that ever create any conflicts or any problems between, you know, the iBank saying, you know, look, we got this warehouse, and this stuff's going in the CDO, whether you like it or not, because we don't want the risk, or words to that effect.
No, I've never heard of it or experienced it. I think the typical conflict would be where we would come in and recommend a security, and then they would not approve it. So the typical way it works is that we would look for securities in the open market, predominantly the new issue market, and we would then submit to the investment bank or whoever the warehouse provider would be at the time, the offering documents and what tranche and what yield level we would like to buy those securities at, and the investment bank would have their counterparties look at it, and since they're in the marketplace as well, they know where these securities are clearing and trading. And to the extent that it makes sense to them on a market basis, they say, okay, that's fine, we'll approve it, and we can go ahead and put our order in to the other seller, and then we would wait for our allocation.
What about
to the extent that we
go ahead?
Okay. Not to the extent that, you know, we get an allocation that was, you know, not that was too low, it might not make sense to take it in.
Mm-hmm. How did it work? I mean, we've looked at Merrill and just the public disclosures on Merrill. You may recall back in October of 2007 when they started to announce a lot of write-downs on their retained interests. We know that starting in, you know, mid to late 2006 and into 2007, you know, they had a lot of retained positions and other warehouse risk, and their strategy at that time was to construct CDOs, retain the super seniors, and sell the subordinate tranches. And I think you guys managed some CDOs with them in that time frame. So how did it work in that situation where the collateral was already there, and you had to determine whether or not it would go into the CDO? What am I not understanding there?
The collateral wasn't always there. I mean, we would enter into every deal we did with Merrill Lynch, we entered into an underwriting agreement and a warehouse agreement at the outset, and then we started buying assets for that deal. It wasn't as if there was a portfolio of assets that Merrill Lynch had, and then came to us and said, okay, we want you to be a manager. Here's the portfolio. We're going to have you as named manager. That's not what happened. What happened was every deal that we did with Merrill Lynch started off with a discussion as to, is there a cash flow arbitrage? And if there is, and we can find the appropriate assets, it would make sense to engage in a CDO issuance process. And then we would start to buy assets into the warehouse.
So what percentage of your assets would you have purchased from Merrill Lynch in the last year? Would you guess?
In the last year.
The last year between middle of 06 to middle of 07.
I can say zero in the last year.
Yeah.
I think it's the assets that we bought from Merrill Lynch was probably, can't recall off the top of my head, but anywhere from 15% to 20% in any particular CDO. I think the CDO where we were looking for assets is who actually originated the assets. So, Royal Bank of Scotland originated our assets. We didn't do a CDO with them. We bought all our assets from RBS because they had the residential mortgage-backed securities that we needed. And we purchased a lot of securities from JP Morgan Chase, where we did no business CDO business with, because they did a substantial amount of mortgage-backed issuance.
Okay. When it comes to asset classes,
it was all done on plan.
Sure. When it comes to assets, another category which shows up, I think, in a lot of CDOs is tranches of other CDOs. How did you look at that as an asset class for arbitrage purposes?
The CDO squares. Ultimately, it's a asset class that was made possible by the CDO technology, by the rating agency's ability to come up with their own assessments of correlations and then create a capital structure. From my point of view, if an investor wanted an exposure to CDO squares, we would be happy to make that investment for them, because no CDO is created in isolation. It's created with the collaboration of the investor, the investment bank, the rating agency, the collateral manager. And so to the extent that all parties agree that it makes sense to do a CDO squared, and we could find the appropriate assets, we would be happy to be named as a collateral manager
on
CDO squared.
So, let me put it a different way. I mean, we had talked about different assets and the arbitrage opportunities available. And you said credit card, not so much as mortgage-backed securities. So how good was the arbitrage opportunity when it came to CDO tranches?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you said, the evolution of the spreads in our marketplace continued to tighten. Even in 2006 timeframe, mortgage-backed securities were tightening. And the levels that these securities were being issued at and new issue were getting richer and richer, and to the point where the arbitrage for 100% only RMBS deal now might not make sense, because the asset yields were being driven down to record low levels. And from the investor's point of view, they looked at the other asset classes and said, well, CDOs that are rated single A yield LIBOR plus 100, whereas single A residential mortgage-backed securities yield LIBOR plus 40. So I'm willing to take CDO exposure to get access to those yields, and that's what happens over time. And so I think the addition of the CDO assets into a CDO was driven by market forces and not by the investment bank or the or the manager or the rating agency or the or any other party unilaterally. Unlike some of those reports in the press by these unnamed sources, that CDOs were added in as a benefit to the investment banks. Well, the CDOs added in because it met the yield arbitrage at the time.
Mm-hmm. So, given those reports, let me just ask you straight out: Did any of the investment banks that you work with simply say, "Look, you don't get the collateral manager job if you don't help us unload the warehouse exposure that we have"?
I was never witnessed it, and never experienced that type of activity.
Okay, you probably all. I'm sorry. Were you finished?
No, exactly. It's the opposite. I mean, we signed the agreement. It's we're trying to find out what makes sense for the arbitrage.
So
not where they say.
So did CDOs you managed ever purchase other CDOs that you managed, tranches of other CDOs
that we managed? Yes, I think any time we bought CDOs that from one CDO that we managed and from to another, it was always fully disclosed in the offering memorandum, and it's always fully vetted by the rating agencies at the time. It's spelled out in the eligibility criteria.
One of the things we've seen, at least in the Merrill CDOs in the fourth quarter of 2006, maybe even a little before that, but certainly fourth quarter of 2006 on, is that it looks like to us that primarily the purchasers of all the tranches beneath the AAA anyway were other collateral managers. You know, in, for example, in some of the deals or in the four or five deals that we saw that Harding did, you know, we primarily see collateral managers purchasing the subordinate tranches in those deals. And then in deals that Merrill did with other collateral managers, we also see collateral managers, including Harding and Maxim, buying the subordinate tranches in those deals. And we see that primarily. You know, we don't see, you know, other types of entities, whether it's hedge funds, insurance companies, banks, et cetera, you know, buying it. And we're, and again, do you have any insight on that? And whether that, are we seeing something that, is that sending us an inaccurate message? Was there a shift in the type of folks that were buying the CDOs in the 06, 07 timeframe?
I think the reason why CDO managers bought other CDOs was, as I said, because of the yield needs for the CDO, that they needed specific yield targets, and that was all driven by market forces. And when you just look at the math behind the CDOs buying other CDOs, it doesn't surprise me that other CDOs bought my deals and I bought their deals, because when you look at the requirements, if the eligibility criteria suggests or states that you have to buy, you know, 30% CDOs in the CDO that you're going to manage, and there's only maybe, you know, 50 to 75 active managers, well, you're gonna buy, you know, and you're keeping 1% exposure to every CDO, you're gonna buy 30 different CDOs. There are 30 different CDO managers, and you're gonna have a lot of cross ownership just because of the nature of the statistics. You know, you have, you know, 50, you know, marbles, and 30 of them happen to be red. You gotta buy so many reds, you're gonna have it dispersed amongst all the other deals. I think that's just the statistical nature of it. And I don't think there's anything other than any other conclusion we can draw from that.
And generally, over time, did you see? You know, you had talked about MBS spreads getting squeezed over time. So as we go from 05 to 06 to 07. Were given that and whatever other factors, did the eligibility criteria change such that they would include larger portions of the higher yielding CDOs?
Yes, yeah, it was all, you know, market driven.
Okay. And I mean, can you give us some color? I mean, was it a dramatic change? Was it a little change? I mean, how did things change in terms of eligibility criteria from 05 to 06 to 07?
Yeah, I don't have the relevant statistics, but I think in general terms, it's probably, you know, CDOs as a percentage of a CDO probably went from, I would say, 5 to 30%. But this is all, as we said earlier, it's done with the collaboration of the investors, you know, whether it's the super senior class, the mezzanine class, the collaboration with the rating agencies, because they're vetting the correlations and they have to be able to rate the capital structure, the collaboration with the investment banks, because they're taking the warehouse risks, and the collaboration with the money managers. And you know, we were not unique in that situation. If you look at the any of the other large managers, that they had a decent exposure to CDOs in their deals.
And I guess
was there any significant difference between high grade and mezz in terms of the CDO limitation?
High grade and mezz, not that I can think of in terms of percentage differences.
So you think the 30% allowance also applied to mezz CDOs?
Yeah, to mezz CDOs and high-grade CDOs.
Okay.
And in terms of those, was there more of an incentive for you guys to have? I mean, I understand you're saying sort of market forces, but I guess my question is, why would it make sense to have, let's say, 10% of a AAA tranche of another CDO in your portfolio over, say, 10% more of a specific, you know, CMBS that was rated as high? I mean, do you understand? Like, what was there a yield, or was there a specific reason or an incentive that you guys may have had to purchase that over another? And I understand, obviously, it had to do with sort of, you know, the collaborative effort and all that. But I guess my question is, was there a a better pay or a greater reason for you guys to own the CDO tranche over some other collateral?
No, there was no incentive to buy one over the other for the manager. If the CDO, for example, a AAA CDO was yielding LIBOR plus 30, and we can find a AAA CMBS yielding LIBOR plus 30, we would be indefinite in terms of the collateral mix because the yield requirements are the same, and the ratings were the same. They both rated AAA. But I think as market forces would dictate, the AAA CMBS was trading substantially tighter than AAA rated CDO, and therefore was not because there was also a test in the CDO that we had to maintain a minimum weighted average spread, and that requirement requires you to buy assets that have a certain level of yield to maintain that threshold.
Right, and were there
even
any...
Even if I wanted to buy...
No, go ahead. Sorry.
No, even if I wanted to buy, you know, treasuries, if I thought the world was going to explode, I couldn't buy it because I would fail my weighted average spread test.
Okay, and I guess my second question, that would be, you know, when you sort of mentioned the market forces, obviously that's, you know, that we understand that, but it's kind of general. I mean, it's incredibly general. So I guess specifically... I mean, do you have a single investor that you can think of off the top of your head who said, you know what, I need 10% CDO for this because that's giving me the yield I want for the overall, you know, somebody who came in and said, we need 10% of a AA CDO tranche because that's giving me the yield that I need for this portfolio to perform to the level that I need. Do you have any specific investors who did that, or even investment bank who said, look, this is something that we'll do and we'll be able to sell it better if we do it this way? Rather than sort of just market forces, do you have kind of a specific idea of somebody who did that?
Not only specific investors that made those kind of requirements in terms of, you know, demanding a I think from the investment banking's point of view, they didn't like to share too much of their actual clients with us because, you know, since we're doing deals with other investment banks, I think they would rather not have us meet their clients, know what they're doing, in fear that we might go to another investment bank and share their client list. So there's always that ability for the investment banks not to want to share that much information. But it was more, I think, in general, just as they're talking to their investors, you know, If you're going to buy a CDO, you know, what asset types are you comfortable owning? And I know generically CDO investors would say, you know, they wouldn't mind holding CDOs because they already invest in CDOs. So, I mean, as long as you believe in the CDO ratings, it makes sense.
Well, and I guess that's kind of my question. I understand what you're saying, but. If you didn't have access to the investors, and you mentioned that you didn't have access
to... No, we had access to investors. I just said they didn't want us to have complete access. Clearly, as we're marketing the CDO, they would have their investors, you know, with the investment bank, talk to us.
And
but I think at that point, the eligibility criteria is pretty well established.
By the time you got... in touch with, well, by the time the investors got in touch with you, or once you were able to speak with them, is that communicate with them? Is that right?
For the mezzanine investors, yes.
Okay. So I mean, I guess
for the AAA investors.
What's that?
No, go ahead.
No,
I said for AAA investors, they tend to be, you know, on board early on in the deal.
Right. I mean, I guess my question sort of goes to the point where you had mentioned that the selection of the criteria was you know, based solely on you guys had that access and it was driven by market forces, but it you know, it sounds as though the main communication you had was with the investment bank and sort of their interpretation maybe of the rating agency, and once the deal was sort of put together and close to finalized, then access to the investor. So I guess that's kind of the concern, is that we want to find out sort of where the delineation is and at what point you guys really were able to, you know, sort of go out and deal with your own. I mean, I guess that's kind of the confusion to me, is that you were saying before that it was a collaborative effort, but it sounds as though the deal was kind of done by the time it came to you, and that's obviously I want to make sure that I'm fully understanding that.
No, the deal wasn't done by the time it comes to us. I think to clarify, during the CDO issuance process, the investment banks need to understand that they're going to sell all those CDO liabilities. So they need to understand the investor requirements and their constraints. And they're finding out from them what sectors that they're willing to take exposure to and what ratings. And because there are CDOs that are done backed by 100% below investment grade collateral. Inman Square, for example, TCW did a deal where every underlying asset deal was below double B, below, and investors wanted that exposure to that, so that got created. But so I think in general terms, in broad strokes, what the investment banks do is what they do best is they look in the capital markets and see what the investors' needs are at the time. Then they come to, they work with the rating agencies because they look at what the ratings criteria is in terms of what is capable of being rated, and then they come to the CDO managers, okay, based on this capital rating structure that the CDO is under and the asset classes, can you buy the appropriate assets that fit this eligibility criteria that meet these yield requirements that we need? And that's the typical creation of a CDO.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chow, let me ask you, we're getting close to the end, so I wanted to ask you some questions that we talked about a little about before, the reports that we have seen in the financial press, and get your response to some of them. And this isn't just you, but generally, as I'm sure you've seen in the financial press, there have been reports, that are claiming, that there's an inherent conflict of interest because investment banks are hiring collateral managers to help dump their subprime exposure, since the collateral managers, as you mentioned, get paid based on the level of assets they're managing. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, I think these stories have always been based on innuendo and not on facts, which is always troubling. Where these would-be journalists that are potentially trying to that want to uncover the truth, but are not really trying to uncover the truth. They're trying to publish spurious information that has, so from my read, has no basis in fact or reality. And it's troubling that they give so much credit to these institutions that continue to publish these kind of stories without delivering real facts and circumstances. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should rely. These are very serious allegations. And there should be real evidence that supports these allegations.
So one phenomenon that one of these articles talked about was two CDOs buying tranches in each other, which, I don't know, it seems like a strange thing. I don't know what to call it. I mean, do you think that sounds like something that shouldn't be allowed, or what's your view on that?
My view is that most managers are indifferent whether you buy... if you buy CDO if you're going to issue CDOs, you believe that the CDO is a bona fide solid investment product. And similar to like Fidelity, if they issue closed end bond funds, should they put one investor into one closed end bond fund over the next? As CDOs is nothing more than these closed end bond funds. When you boil it down.
Well, this would be specifically CDO A buying CDO B and CDO B buying CDO A. So in other words, they're taking risk off of each other. So it raises the question: who's taking the risk?
I'm not sure. I guess that's kind of circuitous. I mean, ultimately, the rating agencies would be the arbiter of that. If they deem that based on their new rating agency model, they can't rate a deal where one CDO buys another CDO. But it's very difficult to meet that test, because what happens if...
I'm not questioning the idea of CDO squared. I'm questioning with this question. I'm questioning just one CDO owning another one that also owns the first one. Kind of cross ownership.
Yeah, I don't think cross ownership. I don't think it generates any undue losses. I mean, if the underlying asset class performs, the CDOs perform. I don't think the linkage of the two is what's adding to the losses. What's creating the losses is the underlying securities have failed and were misrated at the outset. That's what's causing the losses. And I think this notion of that one CDO buying another CDO is creating all these losses is in fact fiction, because when you look at the percentages, they're immaterial. If all the underlying assets performed and these CDOs of other CDOs that were bought into these deals failed, I think the CDO still would have been fine, right, in terms of the cross-ownership concept, because you're only talking maybe a percent or two, a couple percent, 5% max. But if you carry that logic further, say you bought a CDO that didn't invest in your own CDO, another CDO that did invest in your CDO, right? So that's the third derivative. And it keeps on going down that path. It's very difficult to gauge that.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chow, I take it you've read or either heard of accounts in The Big Short about you, and specifically at the January 07 Las Vegas meeting. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple questions about that, because I suspect you may even want to address some of those statements in Mr. Lewis's book.
But can I ask you a quick question before we start?
Of course.
After reading that book, the infamous Chapter 6, did that color your opinion of me to the negative?
No, of course not. We are, you know, that's a book. I mean, but as you can hear, it certainly made us want to ask you certain questions about it, because we want everybody's side. So you can imagine we've talked to a lot of people that are mentioned in that book, in addition to you. So one, I take it you were at the Las Vegas conference. Is that true?
That is true.
Okay. So, the basic thing that I saw in that book that I wanted to ask you if, one, it was true, was, of course, you know, the dinner where you're reportedly with Mr. Eisman, and you tell him, that you'd rather have $50 billion of crappy CDOs than none at all, because you're paid on volume. So my two questions are, is that true? And my second question is, describe us what did in fact happen in terms of that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I think for Michael Lewis, he's paid to stir the pot and not tell a real bona fide story, and hence the reason why his book was number one New York Times bestseller for a while, because he wrote a very outrageous story that clearly piques the imagination of any reader that would read this. My purpose on attending these industry dinners and conferences is to market myself as a CDO manager. In this particular case, I went to a dinner sponsored by Deutsche Bank Securities that would be attended by CDO managers, CDO investors, hedge funds, typical investors in CDOs, and I'm in the process of marketing myself to Deutsche Bank to have them be potentially one of the underwriters of one of my future transactions. And they were going to introduce me to some of their investors, so it made perfect sense to attend the dinner. I did attend the dinner, and I was introduced to Steve Eisman, who, if you ask me today, I couldn't tell you who he looks like or what he looks like. We had a very unmemorable 30-minute dinner. I believe it was at a Japanese restaurant. And as you know, in one of these Japanese restaurants, it was a hibachi style. They handed you food, and it was very difficult to have a real conversation while they're serving you, hot plates of hibachi. All right, so we talked about the industry, and my introduction to Steve Eisman was that he was a potential investor as well. So why would I have this need to disparage myself to a potential investor, to the investment bank that I'm looking to court? We talked about the industry. I don't recall any specifics. Clearly in the credit default swap market, it's a zero-sum game. For every long, there must be a short. And that was the element of the conversation. And at the end of...
Are you there? Hello?
Uh-oh. Should we pause?
Mr. Chow talking about CDS being a zero-sum game.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the first one is a zero-sum game because for every short, there must be a long. And to each part of the party of that trade, each individual or entity has their own belief as to whether they're right or wrong. I mean, it's their investment decision, which is based on the relevant experience. But I think what was amazing is that Steve Eisner would come up and make us. And these allegations that I would make all these other extraneous discussion points where I'm acting in my against my self-interest, because at the end of the day, I'm trying to market myself to Deutsche Bank to be an underwriter of my securities, and I'm trying to find investors. And in the book, Steve Eisner and friends are hiding their hand. I mean, they're saying they don't want to let anyone know what they're doing or how they're doing it, and so. My recollection is that it was an unmemorable dinner, and at the end of the dinner conversation, I got up to leave to go to another meeting. Because in these conferences, all you do is you go from meeting to meeting to meet as many people as possible. What's very troubling in the Michael Lewis book is that there's two versions of this story, in which Michael Lewis writes himself. There's a earlier version that he wrote for Vanity Fair, I believe, and it's the same exact article as what was in Chapter 6, except that the CDO manager was not named. In this earlier version, it was just Steve Eisner having dinner with the CDO manager who made all these claims. And at the end of the conversation, Steve Eisner is so enraged that he gets out of his chair, finds Greg Littman, who's the Deutsche Bank trader who's sponsoring this dinner, mm-hmm. grabs him by the shoulder and points to me and says, I want to short every bond that this guy is managing. In the book version, Michael Lewis has Greg Littman sitting next to Steve Eisner, where at the end of the dinner conversation, Steve Eisner turns to Greg Littman and then points to me and says, I want to short every bond that he has, and Greg acts all surprised. Well, if Greg is in the earlier version, that makes sense because Greg's nowhere to be found, and he acts surprised that he wants to short all my bonds because Greg allegedly thinks I'm a good manager based on what was told on this story, and which makes the most sense. But in the book version, it doesn't make sense that Greg would be surprised, because if he's overhearing this conversation, why would anyone be surprised if they want to short my bonds? I mean, I want to short my own bonds if that was the case. And that's what's so troubling about this story, is that there's two alternate versions of it, and in reality, there can only be one one outcome. So I will like to find out what was on Steve Eisner's mind and Michael Lewis's mind when they crafted this outrageous story. And I think to further the point, I think the. Okay, I lost my train of thought in terms of the.
Hello?
Hello?
I think maybe they put them on mute.
No, I guess I'm bad, sorry. But I think what's surprising is that when you read the story and you read the whole book, you see Steve Eisner's persona, and he had no qualms about this. Disrespecting individuals that he feels are his intellectual inferiors. Now, he disrespected the CEO of Moody's because he thought the Moody's CEO did not know what he was rating. He disrespected one of the presidents of a mortgage origination company during a conference presentation because he didn't believe what he was intellectually equal. For us to believe that he would sit through a half an hour of Wing Chow rambling on as a incoherent, incompetent, fraudulent individual, I'm surprised he did not get up and humiliate me and call me out right on the spot, because that's his DNA. The fact that they changed his modus of operandi for my meeting is completely, befuddles me, and I would like to find out the answer to that in the future.
Yeah. So at this point, because we fell off for a moment, we're but just wanted to make sure that Wing had a chance to finish his thought. Do you have any final questions?
We have a couple of cleanups if we can. I mean, I don't think we have more than a few more minutes.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, one question that comes up when it comes to the synthetic CDOs, which I mean the story kind of talks to, but it doesn't have to. I mean, is there a conflict of interest inherent in the synthetic CDO that doesn't exist in the cash CDO, because you've got both kinds of client, you've got the potential shorts and the longs.
Yeah, there's definitely conflicts of interest, and they should be fully disclosed. And investors, you know, should be made aware of them. I think I think as Warren Buffett clearly, most eloquently put it, he said that, you know, if you're entering into an investment contract with two sophisticated individuals, there's going to be one winner and one loser in a credit default swap market. And unfortunately, that's the nature of the derivatives market. And we can't cry after the fact that, you know, we were duped when, you know, you had all the information at the point in time to make that credit default swap decision.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what about in the case where the equity investor portrays himself as a sponsor but is actually going short, as, you know, has been alleged in some cases? I'm not sure whether it's been proved.
I think the long-short strategy has been around way before the credit default swap market existed. I mean, it's called capital structure arbitrage. In the traditional sense, people would buy either buy stock equity and short their corporate bonds, or they can go long short corporate bonds and go long the equity. It all depends on which part of the capital structure is inefficiently priced, and that's what they call capital structure arbitrage. And in the CDO market, that was also available, where if one party thought that the equity tranche was cheap relative to debt, you would go long the equity and you would short the debt. No more than the same arbitrageur would go long, Ford stock and short the Ford debt. It's a bona fide investment, thesis.
But that same, in that example, that same arbiter is not running Ford. And that's the question, is that if you're long or short, don't you have a conflict if you also are running the CDO itself? I mean, that's kind of where the conflict arises.
If you're running the CDO itself and you're doing it, yes, there is going to be a conflict of interest. But the equity investor is typically a third party, and the collateral manager is independent of that equity investor.
So a couple of
I do believe there are some hedge funds that have been both equity investor and manager, and yes, that should be fully disclosed. I agree with you. There is an inherent conflict of interest there.
Mm-hmm. So earlier when we were talking, about how the iBanks and investors chose collateral managers, particularly investors. So why do you think investors would choose a Harding over a TCW or a BlackRock? What were the competitive advantages and that Harding brought to the table?
Well, I think Harding brought to the table a focused management platform that focused on CDO management, and we weren't this was the sole reason for Harding to exist, as opposed to some of the larger money managers that the CDO business represented another business line to them. For example, Trust Company of the West, BlackRock. The CDO management business was another subsidiary from which they gathered assets under management. For most investors, they also have probably constraints in terms of having too much exposure to one manager. So to the extent that they're overexposed to TCW, they would buy BlackRock. In fact, they're overexposed to BlackRock, they would buy Harding. So there's a lot of reasons why Harding succeeded in the CDO management business, along with other emerging managers. A lot of CDO managers were emerging managers because I think there was a lot of demand for CDO assets, and investors needed a diversified portfolio of managers.
I don't know if you know this, but what about fees? Do you know if you guys, charge lower fees than other folks?
This is Eddie Daniel. But it's fine if you want to just make this your last question. But we budgeted 90 minutes for this, and we've got to run. So, I mean, if you know, I don't. If you got one question that you want to ask, that just to finish up, that's fine. But we're going to have to end the call.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, I'll tell you what I tell everybody. I mean, when we get done with any of these calls, you know, we talk amongst ourselves, and if we figure out we forgot some stuff, you know, we'll get in touch with Mr. Chow's lawyers to follow up.
Sure.
And I understand we had 90 minutes, and if it's a hard stop, you guys need to go, that's fine. We can always talk later. So, yeah, why don't we make this the last question? And that is, generally, and again, if you know, do you know what, like, Merrill Lynch was earning, you know, compared to the other banks that you were collateral manager for?
Yeah, I think in terms of Merrill Lynch underwriting fee for the CDO transaction?
Both, you know, everything, all in.
All in. But I wouldn't know what the all in.
Then what you do know?
No, I wouldn't know the underwriting fee that they would charge for the transaction. I wouldn't know what they earned on their warehouse carry or what else, you know, how much they made on their credit default swaps,
mm-hmm.
desks that were part of this, or how much they made by holding the super senior class.
So in terms of the underwriting fee then, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to get a feel for, you know, and I don't just mean to single out Merrill Lynch, but of the investment banks that you dealt with, was there a difference in the underwriting fees that they were charging?
No, they were fairly standard. I think early on, the underwriting fees been as high as a couple of points to as low as, you know, some as low as 50 basis points. I mean, there was a range. It was all hinged on, you know, what the arbitrage at the time was. But the investment banking fees were fairly standard, similar to the IPO market. I mean, they charge anywhere from 5 to 7 points on IPO market.
Right.
So I think it's similar in the underwriting of CDOs. I think it was anywhere from, 50 basis points to a couple of points, depending on transaction.
Okay. Mr. Chow,
well,
I appreciate the time that you took for us to talk to us today. Like I said, we'll be in touch with your counsel if there's any follow-up questions we want to pursue. All right, guys?
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.